Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. My guest today is Alan Frater, a psychotherapist and teacher at the Psychosynthesis Trust in London. Psychosynthesis is a transpersonal or psycho-spiritual psychology in which the spiritual or soulful is integrated with the psychological. It has its origins in the work of Dr. Roberto Assaggioli, an early pioneer of psychoanalysis, which he studied under Freud and as a contemporary of Carl Jung. On returning to Italy, Assaggioli went beyond psychoanalysis in the formation of psychosynthesis, which includes influences from his lifelong interest in Eastern traditions, such as Buddhism, as well as the esoteric Western traditions, such as alchemy, Neoplatonism, and Kabbalah. However, psychosynthesis was presented as a secular psychology and an empirical science of human subjectivity. The topic of our discussion today will be the origins, aims, and methods of psychosynthesis, as well as the emphasis that Alan has been developing in his teaching, which he calls wild imagination. Hello, Alan. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Great. Thanks, Barry. Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Okay, Alan, then, could you begin perhaps by telling us a bit about your background?
Sure. I'm a psychotherapist at the moment, and I've been teaching at the Psychosynthesis Trust for, I think, 8 years now. I came into psychosynthesis, like many people do, with a background in a spiritual tradition. I was very much involved through my 20s and early 30s in Buddhism, in the Western Buddhist order, and took ordination in 1999. But perhaps like a lot of people in spiritual traditions, I was looking for something else as well, or maybe something to complement the perhaps generalized teachings of Buddhism. Basically, I had to acknowledge I was still depressed and I was looking for more answers. And some of my friends in that world were dabbling in psychosynthesis. So I knew that it was friendly to the spiritual, and I liked the people that I met, and it's developed from there. I've hung in there ever since. Before getting involved in Buddhism, I did a degree in chemical engineering, of all things. I also trained to be a maths teacher. So I was kind of pushed in a sort of scientific bent. My dad was an electrical engineer, so that all seemed very sensible. But it never really fitted with me. I was always bunking off to read Jack Kerouac novels and Herman Hesse novels and going to the art house cinema. So there's always a bubbling background of literature, story, imagination that found a way through in Buddhism and has kind of flourished in psychosynthesis. But I'm originally from a little village outside Edinburgh called Uphall. Been living in London now for 20 years.
Okay, great. And what does spiritual actually mean to you?
What does spiritual mean to me? Well, that's a very good question. And I think I tend to not use the word spiritual. I use the word soulful. I guess they're used synonymously sometimes, but there's different ways into spiritual for me. Sometimes people associate it with higher states of consciousness, with transcendence, with peak experiences, that kind of thing. Sometimes when people mean spiritual, they connect it to living a meaningful life,
yeah,
which doesn't necessarily touch on those peaks, but might do sometimes. For me, that second category is more a soulful life, how to live a meaningful, purposeful life that includes those peak experiences, but isn't focused on them.
Yeah, oh, that resonates very much actually with how I feel about it. I used to be quite resistant to the term because I would often associate it as the opposite of material in a sense.
Yes, yeah.
But connecting it with the idea of meaning and purpose, I'm a lot more comfortable with that.
I think during my life as a Buddhist, one of the distortions in my practice was to transcend, was to inhabit these blissful states of consciousness, to meditate all the time, to kind of get away from the world.
Yeah.
And partly that's why I ended up in psychotherapy, to work that through and come into the messy, scary, risky, exciting business of being in the world, being in relationships.
Yeah.
You can't hide away forever.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, then, so in a nutshell, what is psychosynthesis? We gave you a little bit of an idea about it in the introduction, but could you just maybe unpack that a bit more?
Sure. Well, first off, I think it's important to say that it's a living tradition, to use that phrase. It's a living community, and it's not like there's an authoritative, canonized place to go to find out what psychosynthesis is. It was conceived by this guy, Roberto Saggioli, that you mentioned in the intro, but he was quite generous with his teachings, and it's a somewhat of an open system that has evolved through time. So, for example, where I teach at the Psychosynthesis Trust, the students get exposed to multiple trainers, and it's just evolved in this way. It wasn't really deliberate, but each of the trainers, while they have some coincidence around your question, what is psychosynthesis, they will have different emphases, different takes, depending on who they are, how they've used it, and where they are on their journey in psychosynthesis. So I think that, just as a little proviso, I think that also tells you something about psychosynthesis. It has a comfort with multiplicity. And at the same time, the danger of that is it's maybe slightly difficult to pin down.
Yeah.
But so is life. So here we go. So let me try and get into the basics. And I think an easy way to go is just to stick to the name psychosynthesis. So the name has these two parts, psycho as in psyche from the Greek, and synthesis. Synthesis is perhaps what makes it more particular, but let's just spend a little bit of time on psyche because that can get brushed over. Mm. Psyche is the Greek word. It has three different meanings. I guess the one that we're touching on here, we've mentioned it already, is soul.
Mm-hmm.
Psyche is translated into English as soul. What is soul? Well, if I touch on the other two meanings of psyche, I think that speaks to what soul is and also what psychosynthesis is. Psyche is also breath.
Yeah.
So the word psyche is breath. So what is breath? Breath is a process. It's not a thing. It's not an object. And it has this beautiful fusion between the inside and the outside. Soul is a little bit like that. It's not a thing. It's a process. And it partakes. It's inside us. It's a subjective thing. But it's not just inside us. It's not just like mind. It's not just like the brain. It also connects us to what's around us.
Mm.
The other word that psyche gets used for in the Greek is butterfly. Beautiful. So soul is like a butterfly. It's fragile. It's fleeting. It's not able to be pinned down. You have to sort of follow it around. It doesn't stay still for very long. So I like those connotations that speak to something of what psyche is, what soul is. And maybe we'll come back to that. But synthesis is, well, the easiest way to understand synthesis is that it's the opposite of analysis.
Yeah.
So, which is a reductive approach,
yeah,
in which we try to understand complicated things by separating them down into their smaller parts and then studying those parts in isolation. There's a place for that. But synthesis in psychosynthesis is about bringing together all these different parts into a holistic whole.
And related to that, would you see a compatibility between psychosynthesis and systems theory?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think the interesting thing about psychosynthesis is it was conceived in the first half of the 20th century, before systems theory, before complexity theory, because that all evolved in the 70s and 80s. Saggioli took the inspiration for synthesis, so not from modern science, but from pre-modern sciences, from earlier pre-modern traditions, before we got all reductive, before we Descartes split us up into body and mind. The Greek healing tradition was informed by this holism, because they took people off and they healed them through dream, they healed them through cathartic ritual. They healed them through physical interventions. It was a holistic approach.
Okay.
And that's kind of where we're coming from with synthesis.
What would you say its main aims are?
Okay, well, the aim of psychosynthesis is to bring together psychologically all the scattered fragments and different aspects of the individual into a united whole, a harmonious whole. And then secondly, for that individual to come into relationship in synthesis with the world around them, their relationships, their community, culture, society, environment. That's the kind of long-term goal. Before then, there's a much closer goal that we're working on all the time called disidentification, which is the opposite of identification. Asad Yuli said that whatever we're identified with controls us and limits us, something like that, to paraphrase. So that if we get stuck in being a calm, reasonable, amenable person, and that's how we are in the world, we're identified by that, and that limits us, because then we're cut off from our assertion, our power. Maybe we lose our ability to say no, to exert boundaries, etc., etc. So we can become identified. So the goal, the aim, if you like, is to disidentify, and what that involves is a slow stepping back, not a stepping away from. You still have your calm, reasonable self, but it's to recognize that there are these other selves, if you like, other modes of perception, ways of acting in the world that you can inhabit. So it's a movement towards more of who you are. And as a result of that disidentification, this thing in psychosynthesis called I emerges. I, just a capital I. And I is an emergent phenomena that emerges when we disidentify. Now, it's difficult to explain, but if I give you an analogy, walking is an emergent phenomena. So if we only have one leg, we can hop. But then we have two legs. But we don't just hop around on two legs, which would just be additive. By bringing in the second leg, we walk, and that's a qualitative difference. Yeah. And this state of I is a qualitative difference. It's not another thing. It's not another way of being. It's the consciousness and also the ability to act that arises when we're no longer identified with any particular position.
Very interesting. When you say no longer identified, do you mean not at all, or just holding those identifications more lightly?
Well, that's the tricky thing about talking in this way. It's like to disidentify. So say I'm really, really angry, and somebody said to me, "You're really angry, Alan." And I said, "I'm not angry. You're angry." So that would be me identified with being angry. I'd be so lost in my anger that I wouldn't have any awareness of it. If I was disidentified from that anger, I might still be angry. I would still have the feeling of anger, but I would have some perspective on my experience.
Yeah.
I'd be aware of my anger. I wouldn't be so driven and limited by it.
Yeah.
So you still have the experience. It's like you've got one foot in the experience and another foot slightly back, and you're straddling something.
Okay. Well, could you perhaps describe a typical case study and the process that a person might go through?
Sure. Well, I've dreamed up a fantasy client, a fictitious client called Daniel. He's an Anglican priest. He could be a Buddhist priest or any other kind of priest, but let's just say he's an Anglican priest administering to his flock. And he's come to me for therapy for a couple of reasons. He's beginning to get irritated with his congregation. And in the parish meetings, he's beginning to lose the rag. And he's very concerned about this because his whole identity is wrapped up with being calm and reasonable and spiritual and kind. And he doesn't want to be nasty to people. And then later on, maybe not in the first session, maybe in the third or fourth session, he reveals to me, now that he's beginning to trust me a little bit, that on Fridays, secretly, he goes to a kickboxing class at the other end of the city. And he loves his kickboxing class, but he thinks this is awful and he wants me to help him to give up his kickboxing class. He's ashamed of his kickboxing class. So, I mean, it's a slightly amplified cartoon example for teaching purposes, but I guess the phases that we might go through would be to, first of all, with Daniel, help him realise how he's identified. So we wanted to, I'd be gently reflecting back to him what he likes, which is to say what he's identified with, what he's comfortable with, and then what he doesn't like about himself, which are things over the edge, off the radar, that he's trying to get rid of. Within that, I think first phase, we would have a more psychoanalytic element. So we would be interested in hearing his biographical story.
Okay.
His childhood story. And I'd be interested in helping him to tell the story of how he became the way he is.
Yeah.
So what messages did you learn, Daniel, growing up about anger, etc.? Having realised how he's identified is the first step to disidentifying.
Yeah.
Because that awareness in itself is the first perspective that you could perhaps be something else. Then slowly, gradually, we move into this middle phase, which would be to look at what he's afraid of, what he's trying to get rid of, which is essentially his anger, his assertion, his power. Although it's great that he's trying it out in the kickboxing class. I mean, that's a serious problem. Lots of clients come along and they want you to get rid of experiences that they're having, as if you could sort of amputate an element of their psyche. But essentially, in synthesis, we're helping him to bring himself together so that he doesn't have to skulk off in the kickboxing class. So it would be, the middle phase would be looking at his fears of his assertion, what he's worried might happen if he became more assertive.
Yeah.
And working that through. And I think if you attend to the fears of what's being left out, gradually, slowly, it starts to come in, whatever it is. And then in the latter phases, it would be helping him to ground that and roll that out in his life. And then maybe in his parish, he'd be less meek and mild and perhaps pushed around and start to shape up his parishioners, who are, to be fair, perhaps annoying and need shaping up.
Yeah.
And that, then he might be more effective in his work. So that's a kind of cartoon example. But becoming, noticing how you're identified, exploring what you've left out, the fears of that, and then moving to embrace and roll out what's emerging for you.
Great. Okay. Well, can you tell us something about the active techniques employed in psychosynthesis and what they are designed to do?
Sure. Well, psychosynthesis has got loads of techniques, and I think Roberto Sagioli's main text is called Psychosynthesis, It's Principles and Technique.
Right.
So the subtitle says techniques, but also importantly as a proviso, it's about the principle behind the techniques. It's about knowing why you're applying them and how you're applying them and who you are when you're applying them. They can be quite powerful tools, and they need to be treated carefully. And also, as a little proviso, you can do psychosynthesis without techniques. You could just do it through talking to people. You don't need to do these techniques. But we have techniques. So, for example, just getting someone to write a journal or an evening review, some kind of writing practice. We might get people to go on a guided imagery. So a sort of active imagination, as in Jungian psychology. We might do what we call chair work, where people imagine different aspects of themselves. They personify different aspects of themselves and then dialogue with them, either in imagination or in the consulting room. In all different ways, there's different techniques. Obviously, meditation.
Yeah.
There's an exercise that helps people disidentify. But maybe an example might be helpful.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe guided imagery, which is one of my favorite ones. So say our priest Daniel, I might get to a certain stage in the session and I might say to him, how about we try something differently? How about we look at this issue through imagination? And he'd be like, well, okay, let's try that. So, okay, Daniel, close your eyes. And as you're in touch with this issue and the feeling that it brings up, imagine yourself in a landscape, and when something starts to appear, just describe it to me. That's the starting place for a guided imagery.
Yeah.
So, and then I'll just work to help him describe where he is, who he's with, how he feels about being there, what he would like to do. Within that, I would be very at pains to avoid analytical language.
Okay.
I wouldn't be wanting him to figure out why is he in this scene or what does it mean, because that would take him into a sort of cognitive space.
Okay.
So we want what Coleridge called a suspension of disbelief,
yeah,
which is the imaginal perception that allows us to take the imagery seriously. So you have to really describe it, just use plain language. And the idea is that it's just the contact with the imagery itself is healing and transformative. We can come out of the imagery, and then usually there's a pressure from the client. Well, what does that mean? Because
yeah,
people in our culture are like, they want to, like, I mean, from childhood, they want to know why. So even then, I try to resist being reductive and interpreting the imagery. And what I like to do is, let's say he had a scene in which he was a soldier in a battle and he was fighting, and up on the hill there was a general on a horse looking down over his troops. So I would be saying to him, well, who is the general in your everyday life? Who do you feel is watching you when you're in your everyday life and fighting in this battle? Or where in your everyday life do you find yourself in a battle and embattled? So what we're trying to do is take the imagery from the session, which is all well and good, but we want people to start to see those images as active in their everyday life, in their encounters in their everyday life. And the aim of that would be, again, disidentification. You're helping people to see the character that they are in their everyday life and the story that they're within, and if they want to start to rewrite who they are in the story that they're in.
Fascinating. It reminds me of the expression a bit, fiction is the lie that tells the truth.
Yeah.
Okay, what emphasis would you say is put on the doctor-patient relationship for, you know, effective outcomes? How important is it to connect, and how do you deal with any potential hierarchy issues?
Sure, that's interesting, the hierarchy issues, the power issue between the therapist and the client. Well, it's very important. James Hillman talks about how a painter has an opus. James Hillman, he's an influence of mine. He's an archetypal psychologist, similar to psychosynthesis. He talks about how the painter has their opus as the canvas, and that's shaped by the brush and the colours. So our opus is, as therapists, psyche. We're creating psyche. We're allowing psyche to come into being, to become more whole. And we shape that. Our tool, if you like, is the relationship with the client. That's what limits that emergence and shapes it, very much so. And we talk about how that relationship is a unifying centre in psychosynthesis. So it's a place within which the client can start to unify and get in touch with more of themselves. I mean, it needn't necessarily just be, I mean, lots of things are unifying centres. The kickboxing class for Daniel is a unifying center,
yeah,
because when he goes there, he is witnessed in his power, he is accepted in his power. Similarly, as a therapist, through empathy, through noticing, through attending, acknowledging, and showing our acceptance of that in the client, which perhaps they don't want to acknowledge or accept, slowly that gets internalized in them and they move forwards to embrace more of who they are. Power relationships is interesting, absolutely. So, you know, it's your space, you're the doctor, if you like, inverted commas, they're coming to you, they're paying you money. So there is a power imbalance, absolutely. And the relationship only really works to the extent that you build a trusting and strong therapeutic bond. And a power imbalance will act against that.
Yeah.
So we train people to watch out for those power imbalances and certainly not to be blind to them. I think you have to acknowledge that they're there and not make them worse. And you would be giving the client some choices. You would be making tentative observations, not authoritative observations. That's the main thing to avoid, power imbalance, yeah.
Okay, that makes sense. Its full designation is biopsychosynthesis. So there seems obviously a recognition that you know, that we are embodied beings.
Yeah, that's an interesting one. Biopsychosynthesis is a phrase coined by Saggiuli. It never really took off. No one really calls psychosynthesis biopsychosynthesis. But there's this talk that he gave in 1967, which is quite a good talk, in which he says its real name is biopsychosynthesis. So it's interesting as to why he did that. I guess once something's got a name, it's difficult to change its name. But there was probably a point behind that. My understanding would be, A, first of all, that he was giving an address to a psychosomatic conference.
Right.
So he was trying to speak to his audience. But more usefully, perhaps, I think he was perhaps trying to emphasize that, yes, we are embodied beings, and that in psychosynthesis, the body and sensation have an equal importance to thought, to feeling, to imagination. Not a greater importance, I don't think, but an equal importance.
Okay.
And it can get neglected because people want to transcend. I mean, I wasn't around in the 60s. I came along in 72, but I imagine in the 60s, and this has been a distortion in the history of psychosynthesis, similar to how I mentioned the distortion in my Buddhist history, people wanted to transcend. People wanted to get away from the body.
Yeah.
People wanted to go up through the realms into some kind of higher realization. So he's reminding us that we are embodied and that we experience all this other amazing stuff through the body.
Great. And just following on from that, given the fact that we're embodied beings, that also implies that we're also finite, you know, in our cognitive abilities, in our senses. We're limited by language, by culture, in space and time, etc. So there's this recognition, basically, of uncertainty. How does that tie in with the psychosynthetic model too?
Well, the only certainty is uncertainty. I would entirely agree. we're always talking, I guess this pertains to therapy in general. You're trying to learn to be with that uncertainty, to be with not knowing what's going on.
Yeah.
To resist seizing after a premature synthesis, seizing after facts, staying open for as long as you can, and being with that anxiety that we have when we don't have closure, when we don't know what to do.
To quote Assagioli, in psychosynthesis, everything qualifies as a legitimate object of scientific concern. There exists no reason why, for example, sexuality should be scientific and love not. Could you perhaps explain that perspective a little bit and its practical importance?
Sure. Well, I think the historical context is good there, because he was writing during the 20th century, when empirical science was the predominant paradigm. This is before complexity science, before quantum theory. So to be taken seriously, the psychologies of the day had to become legitimate. They had to present themselves as a science.
Yeah.
And Freud did this. Jung tried to do it and then gave up on it. And Assagioli did this. So essentially what he's saying there is, while sexuality can perhaps be observed in the world, perhaps studied through some kind of anthropological observation, love. So he's interested in these much more intangibles, like love, spiritual experience, the sort of more mystical end of what it means to be human. What happens when you perhaps transcend yourself? He was interested in those experiences, and the way that he presented psychosynthesis was to say that these are subjective experiences, and just as empirical scientists observe things in the world, measure them, we can take love as like a sort of inner object of study.
Yeah.
So he framed psychosynthesis as an inner empiricism of subjectivity. So spiritual experience was an inner experience, and because we felt it, then it was true. So he kind of really emphasized the importance of experience, and that's the humanistic tradition that he was drawn upon there, and that empirical scientific framework. The good thing about that was that it allowed him to talk about these things.
Yeah. And also, just because the experience is at times often messy, doesn't mean
yes.
that you can't gain some traction on the world by observing it. And not everything that, what was that saying by Einstein, that everything that is measurable is valid and not everything. Oh, I forget the actual.
That's the kind of thing that he would say.
Anyway, yes. So how does psychosynthesis differ, you've mentioned Jung, from, say, a Jungian analysis?
Well, I think there's lots of similarities, first of all. I mean, they were contemporaries. So Assadi really studied with Jung. They met, they corresponded over many years. They both had a similar background. They were both medical doctors. They were both very well educated in the religions of the world, in the esoteric traditions, and they both had this kind of spiritual bent. They had this interest in spiritual experiences, which is partly why both of them broke from Freud, because he was reductive, and both of them in their different ways went on to develop psychologies, much more holistic psychologies. Yeah. And another similarity would be within that they both emphasized imagination, story, dream as very important as a means to work with the psyche. I mean, Jung said that image was the language of the psyche, and Assagioli brought in imagination as a psychological function alongside Jung's four functions, which were thinking, feeling, intuition and sensation. Assagioli added in imagination. So there's lots of similarities there. They also both had a collective unconscious. So they were both moving towards the idea of a psyche that was more than just a personal psyche. I think the difference comes back to what I just said earlier about the frame that they had.
Yeah.
Because they were both interested in mystical traditions, but Jung, while he initially presented his psychology as a empirical science, he abandoned that project later on in his life and moved away from that. Assagioli stuck to his guns until the very end. I mean, back in the day, there was a wall of silence, and there was those of his students who he would share his esoteric influences with, and then there'd be all the punters, everyone else, and they would get this secular scientific version.
Interesting.
And I think that's the difference. And I think while that was probably important at the time, and it gained him legitimacy, I think now we can see that it perhaps limited what he was talking about in a way that perhaps Jung wasn't limited by. Because the problem is that the very experiences that he's interested in talking about are the ones that blur the subject-object divide.
Yeah.
It's like when you look at a sunset and you feel really moved, or if you feel a really good conversation with someone, or if you're like really lost in a novel, you sort of step outside yourself. And that's not it's partly a subjective experience, but to say it's entirely an inner experience is sort of human-centric and reductive and ultimately egocentric, I think. And the danger is that you can become, it can almost exacerbate your narcissism, because we're focusing on our subjective experience as the testing ground. So I think the opportunity there at the moment in psychosynthesis, and this is being explored, there's a great book called Revisioning Transpersonal Psychology by a guy called Ferrer. The opportunity is, given that we're in a different cultural climate now and science has moved on, there isn't the need anymore to present psychosynthesis as a inner empiricism of subjectivity.
Yeah.
You know, and there's the chance to maybe not have a wall of silence and bring in some of these influences that Assagioli kept back, maybe to use some of the language from those traditions, to try and find a new story, basically. Because sure. I think that's what we're all trying to do. I think that's what the Middle Way Society is trying to do. I think that's what psychosynthesis is trying to do. Yeah. Trying to find a new story that helps us collectively as humanity step away from this rather sort of isolated, individualistic, narcissistic sense of self, living in a dead world that we can exploit and plunder to impunity. I mean, we need a much more joined up story than that. And I think that's in there in psychosynthesis, if you read between the lines and look for the influence from the past. Yeah.
Where has your own personal interest in psychosynthesis taken you, Alan?
Well, lots of different places. It's been a bit of a journey. But I've always been attracted to the emphasis on imagination. But I've always had a bit of a clash with how that's been spoken about in psychosynthesis. And that happened very early on in my training when I was invited the grip was invited by the trainer to close your eyes, go inside, and find yourself in a meadow. And some of my peers had this wonderful guided imagery exercise where they found themselves in sunlit meadows and they met wonderful, significant figures in their psyche. But I sat there for the whole 20 minutes thinking, how can imagination be inside me? That's just wrong. And like, I knew it was a metaphor, but metaphors reveal and conceal. And I just thought it concealed too much, because for me, imagination is much bigger than that. And for me, imagination is about when you get lost and absorbed in a novel or a movie, and or maybe the characters from the book that you're reading accompany you through your day or even into your dreams. And it's that experience. It's certainly not happening inside me. It's akin to a dream experience where you're actually there in the landscape encountering the characters as autonomous others to you.
Yeah.
So, and in the theory in psychosynthesis, they talk about an inner imagination, they talk about inner characters, they talk about an inner dialogue. So it goes back to the inner empiricism that we've been talking about. And I just thought that really limited how I experienced imagination, and I was looking to understand what that was and to do it differently. So there's a couple of things that I've come up with, one of which is that it kind of controls imagination. I've called it a jam jar imagination, this inner imagination. I also call it a tame imagination, because it's kind of like you've put imagination into a jam jar. You've assumed it's somehow inside you, and that these different characters that you meet there, they're not actually separate to you. They're just bits of you. So it's like your inner anger. It's not a dragon. It's your inner anger. And quite quickly, you can get into an analytic and reductive way of thinking about it.
Yeah.
That makes it safe, but it also creates a separation between you and the images. It's kind of like there's a glass there. It's like going to the zoo. And secondly, if you get lost in the assumptions of an inner imagination, it's kind of like it prevents the images leaking out into your everyday life. You think they're somehow inside you.
Yeah.
So if we go back to that example earlier with Daniel and the guided imagery, I was encouraging him to see the images in his everyday life. That's the kind of thing I do. And what I call that wild imagination. So it's releasing the images, giving them an autonomy to you, and learning to see the activity of them in the world around you, in your interactions with people, and lampposts and trees all the time. And that is a disidentification, and it is a movement towards self-realization, because it's like a movement into an enchanted world, if you like, which is incredibly meaningful, especially when lampposts start to take on a character and become your friends when you walk past them every day.
Does that include vomit and dog turds?
You do want to include it all, wouldn't you?
That was a serious question. Yeah.
Yes.
What is your understanding of the middle way, and how might that relate to what we've been talking about today?
Well, I suppose I go back to my Buddhist days, and when I think of the middle way, most simply, I think of the Buddha talking about the analogy of the lute string and it being overtuned too tight, and then it doesn't sing sweetly, or it's too slack and it doesn't make a note. That's how I think of the middle way. It's like not being too much this thing, too much that thing, trying to find a middle ground. So with regards to psychosynthesis, I guess that goes back to what we were saying. If you're too identified in one way, you've fallen off the middle way, you've gone off the road, you've fallen into the ditch, if you like.
Yeah.
And there's other stuff. You could swing the other way if you like, but again, that would be to identify on the other side of the middle way. So it's like I or disidentification is trying to find a path to walk through the psyche without becoming lost in one mode or another.
Oh, I like that, yeah. Okay. And my last question, Alan, if people wanted to find out more about your work, how would they go about it?
Sure, thanks for asking. I have a website called wildimagination.uk, all lowercase, one word, wildimagination.uk, which is a fledgling website, depending on when you listen to this podcast, I guess. I've also got a YouTube channel, with some videos of me walking around in North London talking about wild imagination with my dog Millie. And you can find that if you go into YouTube and search wild imagination, or you can get it through the website. If you're interested, I teach also, if you're interested in psychosynthesis per se, I teach at the Psychosynthesis Trust. You can get them at psychosynthesistrust.org.uk. And if you are in, not in the UK, there's also the European Federation for Psychosynthesis Psychotherapy, and they are at psychosynthesis.net. So there's a few links there for people if they want to follow things up.
Brilliant. Okay, well, thank you very much for talking to me today, Alan. It's been, you know, it's been really interesting. You've certainly awakened my interest to explore psychosynthesis more, and hopefully you've given people a snapshot of that. And I can also recommend to any listeners out there your short videos. I found them really, really interesting too. So highly recommend them. So yeah, thank you very much for giving up your time today to talk to me.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Barry. It's been really good. Thank you very much.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.